definitions of sick PUVMs in that framework and whether it's at all illuminating or not. That'll be fairly short. And I'm also, since Chris contrasted, I guess, a probabilistic approach to describing quantum mechanics with what I think he called generalized probability theory approach, which is, I think, supposed to be what Alex Wilson, I, and some of our collaborators, approach we take, I thought I might just give a few reasons why I think they're actually closer than perhaps he is suggesting. The second topic is going to be a construction of MUBs based on curves in vector spaces over finite fields. And it's actually more general than MUBs. It constructs nice sets of subspaces that I'm not sure if they're mutually unbiased in the technical sense, but that might be worth investigating. So just in the hope that perhaps this construction might be a little bit illuminating, and if MUBs are actually related to 6, maybe even helpful in finding 6, although I wouldn't bet on it. And then the last thing I guess I'll talk about is just a way of formulating the existence of Weil-Heisenberg 6 as the existence of at least one solution to a set of simultaneous equations in unit modulus complex variables, which I think probably, you know, a lot of people who've messed around with 6 and Weil-Heisenberg have probably come up with this or something rather similar to it, but maybe it's worth putting up anyway. So three fairly different topics. I think I will just shut down the video. Okay. So the first topic relates to Chris's talk on the first day and a bit also to Marcus's. So Chris had wanted to assume there is a set of 6 and look at the simplex of outcome probabilities for a 6, right? And the normalized states form some simplex here. And obviously, this is not a square number of outcomes, but it's just a crude character. And then in this simplex, which here is just a triangle, you know, there would be some funny-shaped convex set of probabilities that could actually come from legal quantum states. And Chris, I think you derived some conditions that such probabilities have to satisfy, right? One of them being maybe something like if you take two legal quantum states with probabilities P and Q for the 6 outcomes, and of course, these probabilities determine the quantum states. Not only do the quantum states determine the probability, but the probabilities come from quantum states because the POBM is informationally complete. So can you remind me what these were? They were maybe something like 1 over d plus 1 here? Is that
two,
right?
2 over d.
2 over d plus 1. And then there's some lower bound here.
It's 1 over.
Yes, it must not be negative 1. Okay. So that's just an example of one of these constraints, and there were other constraints.
Sorry, what are P and Q again?
That's P and Q are the probabilities. So P of I and Q of I are the probabilities for the I equals 1 to d squared, let's say, outcomes of a symmetric informationally complete POBM. So does everybody here know what a symmetric informationally complete POBM is? No, seriously.
That's got to be a joke.
I don't know. You know, yeah, people just come to talks because.
Well, there are two new people here today. There's Chris Hoss, who has papers on them.
Okay.
And there's Lucien Hardy, who has to tolerate me.
All right. But I keep forgetting. What is it again? Yeah. Okay. So everybody.
No, but what I was asking was, are P and Q two different states? Is that?
P and Q are, the probabilities that come from two different
legal states. Okay, sorry, states. I thought you were saying they came from two different sick POVMs.
No, sorry.
Same sick POVMs.
It's possible I said that, because...
Okay, so that's why I was confused.
You know, what I think and what I say.
In any two states.
I understand.
Yeah.
And Q might even equal...
I understand.
So, you know, I guess if you write trace rho equals 1 and trace rho cubed equals 1 in terms of the coefficients, the expansion coefficients of rho in terms of a sick, Chris, that's those equations characterize the pure states, right?
Yeah.
And then you just say it's the convex hull of those.
Yeah.
So presumably one could write down...
And this is some property of that shape, of that convex set.
Yeah. So I presumably that means you could write down... So the question is... So do you think you could write down equations for these... equations and inequalities on these coefficients that would guarantee you that P corresponds to a quantum pure state? Just in terms of the probabilities.
Yes.
So that's something you would like to do. It's something you've actually done.
No.
Okay, so it's still an open problem in this program of Chris and Marcus and Ruby, et cetera. But one might like to have characterized the pure states of this set of quantum states in the SIP representation. Entirely in terms of these probabilities. So I guess even if you could, so I guess one thing that might be interesting is, so suppose you could do that, you still wouldn't have shown the existence of six, right? But you might ask yourself, well, is there any theory, any convex theory, where I can find an informationally complete POBM whose probabilities satisfy those equations that the six would have to satisfy? And I think that would be an independent question. I mean, I'm curious whether that's an independent question. And so the question would be, now I have an arbitrary probabilistic theory. And all such theories, if they're finite dimensional, so I'll explain a little bit more what these things are. But if they're finite dimensional, they have informationally complete POBMs whose elements are on extremal rays of the cone of measurement outcomes. And so you can always represent the state space by a convex body in the probability simplex over an informationally complete POBM, right? The probabilities of outcomes of an informationally complete POBM. And POBM in the generalized sense, right? Of course, by one of these general theories. And so the question would be, suppose I have such a theory, and it's d squared dimensional when I represent it as an unnormalized cone of states. And suppose that you have derived all these constraints on the convex body that would have to exist if seeks existed for the quantum case. But now suppose I have an arbitrary theory, but I can find the POVM where the state set has those relationships. Would it automatically be, it satisfies your equations? Would that automatically... I mean, it's not immediately clear to me that that means that this would therefore be the quantum state space and six would exist. But it's sort of an independently interesting question.
Independent question.
Yeah, so in so that was one thing I wanted to do, just formulate that question. And maybe to formulate it a little bit more precisely, I should say just a few words about what these theories are. And maybe explain to you why they have informationally complete POBMs. It's mathematically nearly trivial. So in this general framework for theories, which is quite closely related to, a framework that Lucien developed for theories, and also related to work that's been done in the 60s, 70s by people like Ludwig, Davies and Lewis, and the early 70s, and just many authors. You have a cone of unnormalized states. So let's just take an ordinary looking
ice cream cone, everybody's standard kind of cone. So this is supposed to be a cone in R3 with a circular base. Just as an example, right? It doesn't have to be a quadratic cone. Because a cone is just it's just a convex set, our kind of cone that we're interested in. The convex set, it's closed under non-negative, so it's a subset of Rn. It's closed under non-negative linear combinations. We take it to be topologically closed, and we take it to be pointed, which means it doesn't contain any full lines. And the reason for those latter two requirements is because we're going to want to have the cone to have a base, which we interpret as the normalized states of our theory. And you get this base just by taking some affine plane and chopping the cone with it. And in fact, we think of this plane as just the set of things such that, so this is the set of omega such that omega being Rn, let's say, such that u of omega is 1. So u belongs to let's say the space of linear functionals on Rn, the dual space, which is isomorphic to Rn, actually. And so u is our functional that computes the norm of the state, if you like. At least if you restrict it to a positive cone, it computes the norm of the state. So that tells us what the normalized states are. And here they're just this disk, which is the normalized states of a real qubit. So that's an example of the state space of one of these theories. And then generally, if you want measurements in this theory, you take, this defines the affine plane, and then if we say omega is also in, so this is the normalized plane, I don't know what we'll call it, A, and then, so if omega is in A, intersect K, then it's a normalized state. So in quantum mechanics, what's the cone? It's just the cone of positive semidefinite operators, or matrices if you like. What's this normalization function? It's just the trace. So that's a state space. And then we need measurement. We want to interpret these points as determining the outcomes of some measurements. And so the sorts of things we can use to calculate measurement outcomes are going to be positive linear functionals on the state space, but they better be positive on all of these unnormalized cones in order that they're positive on all the normalized states, or at least non-negative. And that means they should be in the dual cone. And the dual cone is, not surprisingly, the cone of all functionals that are non-negative on the primal cone. So we have effects E, and they belong to K star. And in fact, since we want the probabilities to be between z and 1, 0 and 1, we take z to be in the unit interval of k star, right? Where u is this normalization function. So this is kind of like the unformative effect, where no matter what state we prepared, we always get the answer yes for this measurement. Yes, no measurement. The analog of POVM is just a set, at least of a finite POVM, let's say. It's a set of these effects that adds up to this unit effect. It's just like adding up to the identity matrix in quantum mechanics. You could entertain theories where you don't actually take all the measurements in the dual cone as sort of operational measurements that your theory actually allows, that's fine. But the more interesting ones, well, I shouldn't say more interesting ones, because if you want to have interesting hidden variable theories, you'll wind up having to do that in many cases. But, at least a mathematically interesting class are the ones where you just take the unit interval in this full dual cone. And this unit effect
is going to have to be in the interior of the toolkit in order to have this slicing work out right and give you a nice compact convex set of normalized states. So I guess the only point I really wanted to make relative to what Chris said, where he was sort of contrasting the idea of starting from probability theory with the idea of trying to go beyond classical probability theory. And so here are these generalized, I like to call them sometimes generalized probabilistic theories, because we're not really generalizing the notion of probability in my point of view. We're just applying the notion of probability to situations where there are alternative things you can do, as in quantum mechanics, alternative measurement procedures you can carry out, alternative ways you can tweak the system. And then you want to describe the probabilities, ordinary probabilities, of the outcomes of the different ways you can tweak the system. So that might lead you to something called the test space, right, where there are, say, many different tests you can make. The test is just a list of outcomes. You define a state on this thing, which assigns a probability to every outcome of every different possible test. And then if you take all the outcomes of one test, they have to add up to one. And then if you look at the set of legal states on a test space, you find out that it spans some real vector space. And you can introduce this set of normalized states in that real vector space. And you can look at the dual space and kind of find your tests in there. And so just starting from the notion that I can do different things to a system and have probabilities of different outcomes, you can recover a structure like this. So in a sense, this structure is motivated by just classical probability. It is a way of just compactly representing classical probability applied to situations where there are different incompatible alternative procedures you can carry out on a system. So I just want to emphasize that this it's not non-commutative probability theory in some funny sense where maybe we replace real number probabilities with non-commutative probabilities or complex numbers, even they're commutative, but they're not ordered nicely. It really is just sort of a nice way of representing very simple-minded application of classical probability to possible candidates for physical theories. Okay, so if that's the basic framework, it's relatively easy to see that there exist informationally complete POVMs whose elements are extremal. And I don't really see, I guess I can get a clock out of this thing. So we started 10th, okay. Yeah. This one where? Oh, okay. It agrees with this one. Right. So an informationally complete observable or measurement, if you like, is a simple idea. It's one of these things where the different EI just span this vector space where the unnormalized state cone lies. They just are a basis. And it's an interesting fact that you can view a cone like this as generated by a set of representatives of its extreme rays, one from each extreme ray. What's an extreme ray? Well, we all know what an extreme point in a convex set is, right? It's a point in a convex set that can't be represented as a non-trivial linear combination of other points. If you take a nice base for a cone like this, you take the extreme points of the base and you look at the ray they generated. Those are called extremal rays in the convex set. So the point is, if you take a set of representatives of the extremal rays, if you take all non-negative linear combinations of those, you get the entire cone. And in particular, that means if you look, if this cone is some cone of measurement outcomes, and you look at the unit, there must be ways of representing it as a non-trivial positive linear combination of representatives of extremal rays. And then by messing about with Kara Theodori's theorem, you can probably even get a minimal set of things that are on extremal rays and add up to the unit that span the space.
Isn't this system?
Well, so probably in the sense that I don't recall the proof right now, I'm not going to put it down. Yeah, so I'm 98% sure that you can do it, and it's been written down. And maybe we'll sit down afterwards and try to do it. But certainly you can get, I mean, certainly you can get informationally complete POEMs whose elements are extremal. That's certain. And I'm fairly sure this other thing is going to follow pretty directly from Carefully first.
So what's certain is that in each one of these convex theories, you can get an informationally complete one that
whose elements are extremal.
Extremal. Yeah. And what's the second thing?
The second thing is that can you get a minimal informationally complete one, right? So whose elements are no larger than they need to be to span the space, the vector space, right? So can you get one? If you're in Rn, can you get one that contains n? Right. Like the sig as well. So I think it's probably relatively simple to show that exists in all dimensions, but I can't guarantee it. So a question might be, can we formulate the notion of informationally of symmetric informationally complete POVM in this abstract framework? And there, you know, for the quantum case, you have an inner product between different POVM elements, right? You can introduce an inner product into this Rn in many ways in general. And any way you introduce an inner product, you can view that as a way of identifying this dual space with the primary space, right? Because so any linear functional on this space I can represent, since we're finite dimensions, by relative to some fixed inner product by a vector x, and the functional corresponding to x is just plug the thing in here and take the inner product. So, for example, if I have a cone like this, and I'm using, you know, the Euclidean inner product associated with decreeing these to be orthonormal, then I want to look at the dual cone with respect to that, and it's going to have to be everything that's at most 90 degrees from everything in the cone. So if this is the primal, you know, this is the dual, according to that particular inner product. If I introduce a different inner product, so I say, oh, I'm actually going to decree these two guys are orthonormal, then the dual cone just coincides with the frontal cone. And in fact, you'd more standardly just write them so they look orthonormal on the board, and you can just look like positive quadrants. So you can introduce different inner products, but sometimes there will be a canonical one. And in this case, there is. We were able to introduce an inner product such that the cone coincided with its dual. And so a cone like that is called self-dual. And it's a nice property whose operational implications I'd like to understand better. But when the cone is self-dual, then there is a canonical inner product. So this is at least one case in which we could think of defining the notion of symmetric informationally complete POVM. Because now we can say, you know, we want a minimal, hopefully, informationally complete POVM that is where all the inner products between the different elements are the same, at least. Yeah, just the same. Yeah, possibly the same in modulus, but
no, they have to be the same because they're all going to be positive. So I'm just going to raise the question of, let's explore that, how interesting it is. How interesting of a notion is it in self-dual theories? And let me make one other point, which is that there might be other reasons for introducing an inner product, or other situations where you might have a natural inner product. And so the other candidate I can think of, which I haven't explored a lot, is if you have a lot of symmetry in your cone, so that there's a natural group action on the cone. For instance, so you have this base. Let's take the old good old ice cream cone again. Here we obviously have a lot of group action. We have, you know, the action of the circle group, SO2, I guess, on this thing, and, well, even O2. And so there may be a natural group invariant inner product that you could introduce, or maybe a group invariant class of inner products. And so possibly in that kind of situation also you might be able to introduce a reasonable notion of symmetric ICPOVM. So just a few sort of trivial examples which we were picking up last night at dinner. Besides the obvious, so an obvious one is just take D squared dimensional classical theory, or actually any dimension classical theory, the orthonormal basis is a sick POVM. So that's sort of a trivial case. Right? I mean, the inner product is all, our inner products are all zero, and it determines the state. So are there any sort of non-trivial examples? Let's look in self-dual cones. Chris pointed out that you can inscribe a regular simplex in a ball, right? And the cones whose bases are balls are self-dual. So there's a natural inner product, and so there's a natural notion of a simplex being regular, of having all the edges be the same length and so forth. And so there is an example that's a little bit less trivial. So one might, you know, if one was interested in these theories that have balls as bases, one might look at the sick POVM and ask, does it have any of these nice properties that were, or conceptual advantages that we're hoping that the quantum one will have? Then, of course, there's real Hilbert space, where I believe we know they do not exist. I mean, real Hilbert space is also, so a set of density matrices over a real Hilbert space, in other words, a set of trace one real symmetric matrices is a nice compact convex set that forms a base for the cone of positive semi-definite real symmetric matrices. But this theory doesn't have sick POVMs, I believe, because of results, is that right, Andrew, on the non-existence of equiangular line sets? So at least it doesn't have sick POV minimal, excuse me?
Yeah. Yeah, but that is also...
It hasn't been proved.
Oh, so it hasn't been proved, is it?
It has been proved in many cases. I wouldn't go that far. I suspect you can do it in a couple of cases, but nothing's been proved. For instance, in dimension 5.
Well, there might be some other
dimension.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's one dimension for which one cannot treat the bell.
But there are examples in 7.23, and nobody knows it.
Yeah, but there are definitely dimensions where the bell cannot be achieved.
Yes. Yeah, okay, so...
Therefore,
it must be as like square.
So I
can learn
this from you. You can't come to
me. Where do you come from?
Okay, so I think I will just leave that as the question of look for other sick PVMs and also think about this first question, whether, if one comes up with the conditions that characterize the shape conditional on the existence of sick PVMs in quantum mechanics, is an interesting question. Just ask, does any theory exist with that that kind of representation, convex representation, whether or not there's quantum mechanics underneath? And move on to a second topic, which is going to be. So I think the second thing I'll do is just quickly go through a way of formulating sick POVM existence conditions in the Weyl-Heisenberg case as just simultaneous equations on a bunch of unit modulus complex variables. And I sort of thought that maybe some of the UNM people had come up with a...
No, we came up with it. I re-derived, I think, exactly what you're going to do. I didn't know that you had done it, but I never found it.
Problem. Okay. Well, maybe you didn't find it. Okay. Good. Good.
If I find it now, I'll stop.
Yeah. So what Steve did was you guys used trace rho cubed equals one as one of the pure state conditions, and I'm going to use p squared equals p for the fiducial vector, basically the projector on a fiducial vector. So they should sort of be closely related.
Well.
But you probably know more about relations.
Sorry. P squared equals p. So you're going to assume that it's a density operator. So just tell us what you're going to do.
Yeah.
But if it's Hermitian, then it's enough. And it doesn't need to be a density operator. It's Hermitian, it squares to itself. And it's
yeah, but you don't know that.
Well, what if it's Hermitian, trace 1, and p squared equals p?
Yeah, then it's...
Right. So, yeah. All right, so I'm going to call these things DXP. Those are some Weyl-Heisenberg generators. They're just the shift and phase operators. So I probably don't need to define those again, right? They're just generated by D, which shifts things one cyclically in a standard basis, and D0P, which just is diagonal with powers of a root of unity, integer increasing powers of a root of unity getting diagonal. So let's make this about as short as we can. So there's a, okay, then I guess I redefine things and let exp equal mu to the xp, and this may be a silly way of choosing the phases, but it's what I'm going to do. Sum over I, omega to the pi, I plus x, I, and, we're going to assume here that p is a prime. So we're in prime dimension.
What does that p have anything to do with?
Or does it?
Sorry, you're talking about omega. Omega is the root of unity with a prime.
Yeah.
So it's a primitive.
Yeah, sorry, p. Sorry, this p is not this p is that p.
What is mu?
I'll tell you in a second.
Okay.
Right, so we're going to assume the dimension is prime, right? Yeah, P is not prime.
Okay.
It's not. All right, so I chose
the number of 1, 1, 0 to the dimension minus 1.
Okay. Yeah. Mu to be a primitive 2D root of unity. Okay. So this may be a dumb, unnecessary complication. And you can do it with another base choice, but that's what I did. So, I think the reason was because I thought the phases worked out better. So if we just added this phase, basically. Okay, and so then we get multiplication rules like EXP, EYQ is mu to the xp minus xq minus py here, e to the x plus y. So there's this sort of symplectic inner product between the indices as a phase factor here. Okay, so the basic idea is very simple. It's just to take our assumed fiducial vector psi psi for a Heisenberg file seq, so the orbit under conjugation by the group generated by these things of this psi is a seq, is going to be assumed to be a seq, and then see what that implies in this representation. So we expand it okay, so let's call this C sub M N E M N. So these are an operator basis, so we're going to expand our fiducial state in terms of them. Okay, so the next thing we want to do is just look at the inner product requirement for being elements of a SIC. And if you, right, so that means that if you take the trace of this thing with its Weyl-Heisenberg conjugate, for any Weyl-Heisenberg conjugate, that should have modulus. This should have modulus 1 over d plus 1. Is that right?
No, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And, and so basically from that, you can quickly get that CMN squared is 1 over d squared d plus 1 for mn not equal to 0, 0. You have to take account of the fact that the...
it must be 1, the worst expressless.
Excuse me?
C0, 0 is just 1.
Yeah, that's why C0, yeah. That's why C0, 0 is not in here, because that gives you the trace on the first expressless. So this comes from the SIC condition, or at least the inner products condition. And now we just have to incorporate the fact that these things are pure states and positive semidefinite, well, pure states, pure quantum states. All right.
Yeah, so I mean, you've already... Your notation makes it seem like you've already assumed that, but you haven't. If I were doing this, I would have written rho equals sum on CMN, EMN. Because you have not enforced the fact that this is a pure state yet. So really all you have
is
formation operator, which has an extension. Actually, you haven't even enforced its formation.
So let's just call it
some relationships between the CMNs.
That's absolutely right.
So you need that C is Hermitian.
Let me see where that comes in. It's something like I'm gonna throw that in at the end. But so if we already know what the trace one condition is, Marcus said it. It's C0, 0 equals 1. Then we've got the C squared equals C condition, and I do start calling C here. And that just boils down to CMN equals sum ij, C ij, C M minus I, N minus J, arithmetic should be modulo of the prime, mu to the IN minus JM.
So there's this funny kind of, you know, double convolution with this money phase, which.
And there's some extra requirements, right? Like CMN has to be
so
C well, star
minus N
minus N or something.
Yeah, yeah. So okay. I'll throw that in at the end. That's relativistic.
Okay.
CMN equals C star minus C minus N minus N star.
Yeah.
This thing which you call a funny convolution is called a twisted convolution.
I sometimes call it twisted convolution.
It's actually a technical term.
Yeah. But I would like to understand more about why it's a technical term. So maybe we should talk about that.
It's a bit like an autocorrelation.
Well, it looks a bit like it, except it's twisted, and it's got.
It's not twisted autocorrelation.
Well, it's like a convolution with a character tacked on or something. Yeah.
There's a twisted group algebra. Maybe it's got something to do with that. I just want to show you guys what this thing is, and maybe you will recognize it, and we'll be able to apply some tools from some other area where the word twisted comes in, or maybe you'll recognize that you've already been down this route and it doesn't lead anywhere. But, okay. So, these CMN, we said, all have the same modulus, so that's nice. So we can actually just define unit modulus variables, ZMN, which are just CMN normalized. So they're times D root D plus 1 is like X. Is that consistent with what? Yes, it is. Okay. And then, so if you mess about with this, with just a bit of algebra, you wind up getting ZMN. No, let's just skip the algebra and yeah. You wind up getting d minus 2 root d plus 1 zmn equals the sum over ij, which are not either 0, 0 or mn. Right. And then what do we add up? Well, okay, I should have let myself more room. ZMN. So then I want this twisted thing. ZIJ. I mean, this really isn't much but a way of rewriting this other equation. Z. M minus I, N minus J, the funny phase factor again, this is eclectic thing. Okay, so there you have a bunch of simultaneous And then let's not forget Z minus M minus N equals Z M N star. So this isn't really a polynomial equation, but these are a bunch of polynomial equations in unit modulus complex variables. And then we have this further restriction. So I would really like it if somebody could, and I wasted a little bit of time looking for these things and didn't come up with anything useful, but you know, look at the theory of algebraic sets on the torus, the complex torus.
I think you can show also that number on the left-hand side is an upper bound.
This number is an upper bound for
the exponential sum on the right.
Okay.
So you can eliminate the ZMN by multiplying by the conjugate, right? And then it appears on the right-hand side, right? It's unit modulus, so you multiply by Z minus N, and then put that on the right-hand side.
But now you
factors out of the sum, right?
Now you just want to, okay.
I don't think you can unless you assume that you have something like quadratic function, that the Zs are quadratic.
Sure, you can do it.
You can't put bounds on exponential functions unless you know that there's like bias or Gauss sums.
No, but if it violated that bound, then it would violate positivity.
So if you want to stick in a z minus n minus n there and have a triple sum, then maybe it reverses that.
Yeah, and then I think you can show that it's an upper bound.
You can show that this is an upper bound that you're trying to meet.
Yeah, and you're trying
for
to
each,
meet it.
And you're trying to meet it for all mn.
That's right. So there's d. So naively, if those were random phases on the right, and you summed up a bunch of d squared of them, right, you would expect, that's like a random walk, you would expect that that sum would saturate order d, right? So we're trying to do much, much better than that. We're trying to go to order d to the 3/2. And it's really hard to saturate that, I think. But I mean, there's a lot of algebraic structure here, so.
Yeah, so I'd like to hear more about these sorts of things. And this is sort of saying if you take this thing's twisted convolution with itself, it's proportional to, it's proportional to itself. And that's the proportionality kind of thing.
Where does the prime dimension enter?
Where does the prime dimension enter? Well, I'm not absolutely sure that it enters.
No, it doesn't.
Okay. I may not even have written down that. You're right. Yeah, and the fact that I wrote D instead of P suggests that.
And I think
it could be just because I want to peek something else, but no, I think this works.
You could do a similar derivation for other nice error bases as well, right? Because in order to get that the CMNs are unit modulus, I think you probably only need properties of the nice error bases, right? Because you're expanding the Cs, the big C, as coefficients in some nice
that might
bases.
Be, I mean, this
and then you're using the fact that there's this.
I don't know if you get this nice.
Well, no, it'll be a different mu if it's not Heisenberg, but.
I mean, a different way of calculating this from the index.
Oh, yeah.
It won't necessarily be
that thing will be that the mu and its function of the I, j, m, and n will be vastly different, presumably. But I think you could do something similar for any of these.
I mean, if there are an error basis that comes from an abelian group, it might not be that good.
Yeah, it might not.
Just be
well, there are error bases which comes from the abelian group that it is exactly that.
Not in.
I believe it's so. Because there's only one kind of. Well, you can classify all of
them. Oh,
okay. You can classify all of projective representations, and it's basically exactly that is the only possibility.
Yeah, didn't we have this suspicion?
Well, what about
this
prime power?
Yeah, I avoid that suspicion over and over again. Yeah.
Okay, that's right. So there are now order d squared unknowns.
Yeah.
But they're really not independent, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly not claiming this is the most reduced form of these things. But
right.
I mean, the main thing I like about it relative to other ways of writing a thing down is that there's no free amplitudes of things. There's only phases.
Yeah.
But I'd like to see later your proof. If you can show this as an upper bound, that would be
so. Nice. So this is also this has to be true for all n.
Uh-huh.
And you can eliminate the so you essentially have order d squared equations as well. You can eliminate so you can formulate
well,
this.
Well, right here there's order d squared, and then you can probably use this to get rid of.
Well, no, that's only going to get rid of half of them.
Well, sure. Right? Okay.
But what you can do instead is you can use the fact that if you have a Hermitian operator and trace row squared equals trace row cubed equals 1, it's a pure state. And then you get down to, because it's quadratic equations. But you can get a single cubic equation with a slightly different factor on the other side, and you can show it's an upper bound. So then it's a single cubic polynomial in phases, has to saturate some bound.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I guess it's a matter of taste whether you like one cubic with lots of variables or a bunch of quadratics.
Lots of variables. A bit of taste where you want to be.
Yeah,
that's fair.
Okay, so I guess I have 1 minute left by this clock. So I could just very rapidly sketch the connection between MUBs and normal rational curves over finite fields. Or I can skip that. But why don't I just give you the very fast version? I'll just try to write down. Okay, so let's say we're looking over a field FQ to the Q to the S, let's say. So a normal rational curve, and let's say we have a are we going to make it R-dimensional vector space? Yeah, we will. So let's say we have a 2R-dimensional vector space. The 2R is just because we want to have this be... We want 2 in here so we can think of these as determining quantum paracorrecting codes, right? It's not necessary in the definition of a normal rational curve. But this is going to be like having R systems that are each Q to the S dimensional, and using elements of F Q to the S to index both the amplitude and phase of the of an error basis. And so, you know, the index group of this error basis is going to be the additive group of F Q to the S. So let's look at the normal rational curve over this thing that's going to be given by a bunch of points. So we have 1, we have y, we have y squared, and then we're going to go all the way up to y to the dimension minus 1. And then we're going to have one other point, which is going to just be 0, and then the last component is going to be 1. Okay, and then the y varies over the field. So we said it was fq to the what? S. Okay, so that determines a curve in this vector space of 2r dimensions over vfq to the s. Sorry, gfq to the s. And these normal rational curves have the nice property that their points in them are in general position, which means that if you take the dimensions worth of points, they're linearly independent. So the points are in general position. And I would guess, although I haven't, you know, verified this, maybe it's not true, but I don't know, maybe there are a maximal set of points in general position that you couldn't make a bigger one. Does anybody know? Okay, so right. So now, in the case where, So I'm going to argue that the case where r equals 1 is going to give you MUBs. Sorry, R is 1, so we have the two-dimensional vector space over Q to the S gives you MUBs. And the basic reason for this is that you get a MUB. Okay, so I think there are various ways you can see this, but in particular, I think there's a paper by Boykin and Roy Chowdhury where they show that if you can partition an error basis, a unitary error basis, into an equal number, into equal cardinality so if you're in dimension D and you can partition an error basis into D plus 1 equal size, a unitary error basis, D plus 1 equal size sets, and they're commuting within each set. Each set is a set of commuting things. then that gives you a set of MUBs, and the MUBs are just labeled by each basis corresponds to one of these commuting sets, and the different vectors are just the different lists of eigenvalues that you can have for the elements of that error basis. So in other words, if these error bases, you know, form one of these nice error groups that we use for stabilizer coding, these are just stabilizer, one-dimensional, you can think of the MUB as a one-dimensional stabilizer code plus all of the coset spaces or syndrome spaces, if you like. All of the erroneous orthogonal one-dimensional subspaces that are labeled by the different syndromes. And then, so this gives you like a family of one-dimensional stabilizer codes. And they're, you know, they're not orthogonal to each other, they're overlapping, and they have this very nice property of uniformly overlapping. You know, each pair of these stabilizer codes is in the same geometric relation to each other one. Okay, so the reason we actually looked at these normal rational curves with R not equal to 1 was, in fact, to get similar families of stabilizer codes that are not one-dimensional, but still have this property that's kind of like mutual unbiasedness with respect to each other. Okay. So I guess the thing I want to say is that, okay, so how do these give you the MUBs in this case? Yeah, so we should have, I mean, there's Q to the S elements here, and there's one more, so we've got Q to the S plus one elements in the curve. So if you look at an error basis, you know, if you look at an error basis that's indexed by elements of this field, an error basis for a Q to the S dimensional quantum system, then this this curve does, of course, now you've only got two elements here, but this curve does partition the error basis. The elements of the partition, so each partition determines one of these mutually unbiased bases as a one-dimensional stabilizer code. So I think I just wanted to sketch that, and then perhaps we can later see if it's useful, if there's any relation to 6, or probably not, is what I suspect. Okay, so that's all three topics. Thanks.
And if you actually want to see the details of this, I should point out it's in a paper in Fox 2002 with Crapo, Gottesman, Smith, Tapp, and also me. And I think it's called Quantum Authentication Codes or Authentication of Quantum Messages or something like that.
What is Fox?
Excuse me?
What is Fox?
Good point. It is the something.
It's summation.
The N for some N, I don't know, annual.
OS annual.
And something, ACM or IEEE conference on the foundations of computer science. But you can also find this on QuantPH by just looking for the authentication.
So the point being that these subspaces, when they're not one-dimensional, this collection of quantum codes forms a way of helping to authenticate quantum state, because you encode them in one of these things, which one is secret. The fact that they're not orthogonal means it's hard to mess about with it without moving it into one of the bad ones. And it turns out you also have to encrypt to really operate on the right? So you encrypt and then you decode it for it. So encryption B and the authentication key.
Thanks, Howard. And I guess Marcus is going to tell us about.
We'll take some
5 minute strike, and then Marcus is going to tell us dimensions divisible by 3.
That's right.
And